Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 16th of June. And I'd like to start immediately with our colleagues of UNHCR. Carlotta, you want to start and introduce Jackie, please?
Apologies. Good morning, everyone. From UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, we're very pleased to be here. And I'm very pleased to introduce to you all Jackie Keegan, who's the Deputy Director of our Division of International Protection and Solutions, and in particular heading our team working on durable solutions and field protection support. So global team supporting all our colleagues working on solutions and protection, including in emergencies. She has extensive experience in the field as well as headquarters in international protection and solutions. And currently she's attending important consultations, 2 days of consultations on resettlement and complementary pathways, which is our annual multilateral event, bringing together member states, the private sector, academia, NGOs, and refugees themselves to discuss and advance resettlement policy. And she will brief about our newly released report on projected resettlement needs for next year. And she, of course, will also be available for any questions. So without further ado, Jackie, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlotta. Good morning. We released today the projected global resettlement needs for 2027. It's an annual report that establishes through a series of consultations and analysis projections related to the needs for people who are to be, that gives us the numbers of people and indeed the locations and the specific needs of those who need to be resettled, who need to go from their country of current asylum to a new country in order to find both protection and solutions. This year, the numbers have dropped slightly from last year. We're down to 2.4 million people around the world requiring resettlement. These are people who still face protection needs in their country of asylum and who are still unable to return home. The figure represents a 6% decline compared to 2026 and continues a downward trend since 2025. That reduction reflects specific developments in certain contexts. Some of those are promising and some of them are challenging. In Syria, the changing government in December 2024 opened up the way for voluntary return despite fragility. It reduced protection needs for some. In contrast, lower predicted resettlement needs for Afghans in Iran and in Pakistan linked to return under adverse circumstances. Afghans remain the largest group in need of resettlement, followed by refugees from South Sudan, Sudan, Syria, and of course Rohingya refugees, who are mostly in Bangladesh and continue to face acute risks and limited alternatives. Regionally, resettlement needs remain the highest in Eastern and Southern Africa, followed by Asia and the Pacific, and then West and Central Africa. In 2025, approximately 37,000 refugees departed to a new country through UNHCR-assisted resettlement globally, down significantly from more than 116,000 in 2024, and only a fraction of those in need around the world. In 2022, the international community set a target of 130,000 resettlement places for 2027, but declining quotas mean that goal is unlikely to be met. This reflects a combination of policy changes in destination countries that have led to pauses in admissions, to more restrictive criteria, and to processing backlogs. The challenges in destination countries are real, but we should not forget that many of the countries that host large numbers of refugees call for expanded resettlement as a form of international responsibility sharing. Low and middle income countries host 68% of the refugees around the world. And while most continue to show generosity, they also face strain on local resources and capacities. Resettlement, which was the first solution that the international community implemented after World War II, is a key pillar of UN High Commissioner of Refugees Baham Saleh's drive to halve the number of refugees in protracted situations reliant on humanitarian assistance by 2035. As we mark the 75th anniversary of the 1951 Convention this year, recommitting to protection and solutions is more critical than ever. Resettlement helps relieve pressure on host countries, strengthens partnerships, contributes to stability, and helps reduce dangerous onward journeys. Expanding resettlement is urgent and achievable. Increased quotas, bringing more countries on board, and accelerating processing would ensure this life-saving tool reaches more of those in need. Resettlement is not a charity. It's an enduring solution that helps to break displacement cycle for future generations. Resettled refugees contribute to their new communities through work and entrepreneurship, while also supporting families in their countries of origin or asylum. UNHCR thanks resettlement countries that continue to lead by example. Every place rebuilds a life.
Thank you. If there are questions for you in the room, Christiane, the German musicians.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions. One is, can you give us two or three examples of concrete situations why a person in a country does need resettlement and has no option of staying there or going home, just to put some more context on it. And with this question goes the other one, for example, the 1 million refugees, Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. How do you choose a few that you think need resettlement, whereas everyone else also cannot stay and cannot go home? How is the difference between those you say need resettlement and those who don't? And excuse me, for I will indulge your patience. Countries in the Middle East receptive? Do they offer resettlement places? Because maybe, for example, for Rohingya refugees who might who are Muslim by religion, for them it might be easier to settle in a country that is also a Muslim country. I wonder whether there are any places in the Middle East, in any of those countries, offered for resettlement. Thank you.
A lot of questions. Okay, so the first one, some examples. When I started doing resettlement 20-something years ago, I was working in the Republic of Guinea.
Could you also speak a bit more slowly?
Sorry. When I started doing resettlement some 20-something years ago, I was working in the Republic of Guinea with Sierra Leonean and Liberian refugees. And the very first people I met were a group of women who had been sex slaves with militia groups. They were living in hiding in the refugee camps. They were unable to secure protection from their families and their communities because they were perceived as having been excluded from good, from proper society because they had slept with men who were not their husbands. They had children from multiple men. They were in danger. And when we submitted them to the UK, it was the beginning of the British resettlement program. The very fact of having been submitted meant that they started to look after themselves better. They started to look after their children better. And even though they were still living a very restricted life in the communities in the camp, they started to flower as humans. By the time they got to the UK, they learned English. They went and they created choir groups. They worked in municipal government. They were people who had no opportunity in their society at all, either in the refugee camp or at home when their people started to go home. But in another country, they were able to start again and they were able to look after their children the way they should. They're living ordinary lives there today. They're wonderful. The other situation is when we're looking at people who, while they have demonstrated their resilience and their ability to adapt through fleeing and reestablishing themselves in a new place, they in fact have a specific need that is greater than can be addressed in the country of asylum. So insulin-dependent diabetics, for example, people who have need for chronic illness that requires a cold chain to establish their medication, something that would be quite easy to do in a country where there's reliable electricity, where primary health care is available, but that is a huge drain on the very limited medical resources of a hosting community. And so they are, the people who are selected on the basis of their immediate need, perhaps their protection needs, even in asylum, and of the fact that the community has needs to husband its resources and look after the greatest number of people. With regard to a million refugees and how you choose them, in a way it's the same story, but we of course don't work blind, right? We have all of those million people in Bangladesh are registered. We understand their family dynamics. We understand their level of education. We follow their family every time they have any engagement with us or with the government. And so we start to understand those who are more vulnerable in society. A million people is a city. It's the same thing that happens in any city. You know, if you're working with a community, which are the people who are most in need of that additional help. So together, these days, together with refugees, together with the broader community, with the government, with NGOs, we identify the criteria, the sorts of characteristics that people would need in order to require that additional help. And then from there we go and we work through with the individuals to find out where we are best able to find that help. And it's a painstaking process. It's why we have this considerable analysis that we put out at the beginning of the year, because we want people to understand that if they're going to make decisions about quota, then they're drawing on that wealth of knowledge and that presence that we're lucky enough to be able to ensure. The Middle East has, of course, taken people for resettlement over time, but like every other country, we're in these consultations right now. We've just heard from Germany that one of the reasons that they've suspended their resettlement program at the minute is because they're really focusing on the people they have in country, including those who came from Ukraine. Germany's been a long supporter of resettlement, and they're still in the room as a resettlement country. There are many resettled people there. But in the case of a country that is trying to deal with the situation it's got right now, it's made the decision to focus internally. I very much hope that we'll be able to encourage not only Middle Eastern countries, but more countries in Asia, other countries around the world, to come back to resettlement. Something to note, in the 1950s, we had some 37 resettlement countries resettling from Europe. So, you know, we're looking at a changing world every year. We have different countries starting and stopping according to their capacities.
Thank you very much. Other questions in the room? If not, I go to the platform. Satoko Adachi. Oh, Alex. Well, sorry, I have given her the mic. I'll come back to you in a second. Satoko Adachi, Yomiuri Shimbun.
Yes, thank you very much for doing this. Could you give us your view on...
Satoko, sorry, we can't hear you. I don't know if it's... Maybe we have to... Maybe you can put your volume higher and try again.
Can you hear me?
No.
Hello?
We can't hear you. Let me see if my colleagues can do something. In the meantime, we'll listen to Alex, AFP.
Yes, thank you for this briefing. First question, I just wanted to know, when are you going to share the report? Because we don't have it yet.
It's coming to your inboxes with the briefing note as well as the link to the report.
Okay.
Imminently. Yeah.
Thank you. Just wanted to know, can you tell us why there's been such a drop in the resettlement offers? You're saying this reflects a combination of policy changes in destination countries. Is it only about the US or also other countries? And what kind of signals are you receiving from countries that might increase the number of resettlements?
No, it isn't just the US. Countries that have long been resettlement countries have either dropped their quota or have suspended. We've also had some countries that are signaling that they're coming back and offering more quota again. It is not a stable environment. Every country has to work with its different challenges. In some cases, the countries that are reducing their quotas are doing so because, in a way, we've been victim of our own success. We, with the drop in numbers, we've been very careful to select the people who are most in need, and often those people have a high settlement cost at the beginning, and so therefore the same budget allocation covers fewer arrivals, but it makes sure that the people who are looked after are properly looked after and are able to then become independent more quickly. In other situations, it has to do with housing. I think we're all aware of the global housing shortage, and so if we're bringing new people into a country who don't already have a community that can help them with housing, then sometimes resettlement places are constrained literally just by the places people have to stay. In other situations, there are commitments made by countries to, for example, Afghans or to Ukrainians, where the numbers perhaps were greater than they had anticipated, and so they need to take people out of the waiting list. You know, waiting for many years in order to come to a new country is not dignified and not appropriate, and so countries very properly are trying to work through their application backlogs. There are all sorts of different reasons that a committed country might have fewer resettlement places at one time. Why do they come back? I think there's a genuine feeling of solidarity. As I said, we're in these consultations with, I think there are seven countries in the room that this year do not have a quota, but that are considering looking at what's happening around them. They're studying what works and what doesn't. We're trying to make sure that this resettlement community remains a community, and in fact that we do things better every year. So those that are considering coming back have thought about the way that they've dealt, that they deal with integration. They're working with local communities, local municipalities, differently, and they're finding ways to contribute to the needs that are put forward in the projected global resettlement needs via resettlement in a way that matches their societies and their communities. I know that we're in a challenging time, and we desperately need more places. We need many more places, but I think the fact that the countries that we're working with are so carefully thinking about how they can do this in a way that is responsible and reflective of the needs of the people who are coming is in a way a positive thing as well. We're trying to make this last and make sure that it's durable and sustainable.
Thank you very much. Satoko, I see you've written your question in the chat, but maybe we can try again to hear you directly, and if it doesn't work, I read it.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Okay, thank you very much for doing this. I would like to get your view on the EU establishing the return hubs as part of its overhaul of its migration and asylum policies. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, obviously, I can't get into this in huge amount of detail, but the reality is that it is crucial for those who need to seek international protection that they are able to find a place where they can be safe from forced return, from informal. And part of making sure that that system is available is ensuring that asylum systems around the world are able to conduct fair and organized procedures. So the fact that there are people who apply for asylum who have perhaps no other option but to, you know, that there aren't migration options available to them, they use the asylum system in order to seek opportunity, which is understandable, but it also is important that those who are not in need of international protection are able to go home, that they don't take up places from people who really do need international protection, who need to be protected against return to danger, which they would find at home. And so establishing a system whereby an orderly procedure can be put in place for those who are not in need of international protection is one of the things that governments do, and we're working with the European states and with others on their options around that.
Merci. Gorky Ndoye, continue, Premier.
Bonjour.
Bonjour, Gorky.
Well, I have a little question regarding the countries. If she is able to give me the five first countries who are receiving refugees in the world. This is my first question.
Gorky, si vous en avez une autre, posez-la maintenant comme ça, elle peut répondre aux deux questions.
D'accord. And j'étais un peu étonné par rapport à the receiving countries, you know. She said that she used to work in Guinea. I know that Guinea used to be one of the most important countries in the world receiving refugees. And I don't understand the explanation she gave regarding how people are keen on going out from Guinea to go to Great Britain, maybe I do not understand really what she meant, but whatever. So the real question is if she is able to give me the five first countries in the world right now receiving refugees. Thank you for your
Merci.
Help.
Merci beaucoup.
With regard to, and I'm going to have to direct you to the, I'm going to come back to you, I think, on the statistics with regard to the five countries. Is it the five countries that most are receiving
the most highest number of receivers?
Of resettlement countries?
Yes.
And then receiving, not receiving refugees, resettlement countries?
Well, he said receiving refugees, so I'm not sure.
Okay, I'm going to come back to you maybe with both of those figures. We've got some colleagues who are going to figure that out for me. Would you like me,
He wanted to understand what you meant when, because refugee in Guinea, you were speaking about the difficulties, and he thought that the Guinea was one of the countries that was receiving most
right.
refugees. So why do you send them to the UK?
Okay. So obviously the story that I told was a story from a long time ago, because I wanted to illustrate a very specific situation, which was the request of the earlier question. But what the today, and maybe that's the more interesting thing, when there are people who flee their country of origin and who arrive in a refugee hosting country, whether they live in a camp or a city or a rural area, who are unable to find real protection, effective protection in their country of asylum, we look at their situation to see if they might not need to be resettled to a third country. So there are people in every society who are living in the margins of that society. They might be from an ethnic minority. They might be single women who have children who are not protected by a male household member in a society that relies on male protection. They might be a person with a particular disability or who has a particular physical characteristic that isolates them from their society. And the reality is that when people flee and they need to rebuild their lives, they need to rely on their communities. So therefore, people who are on the outside of their communities are the people who are the most vulnerable in this new situation. If they can't rely on family, if they can't rely on their neighbors, if they can't rely on their community for those daily protections, if they're unable to safely send their children to school or go to the market, then possibly a new country is necessary for them. And so our responsibility in that situation is to identify them and to see if we can find a new country that helps them to build an ordinary life. And the reason I told the story about Guinea is because this was 20 years ago, and so we've seen the impact of their resettlement. There were 20 women who went with their families there, and 20 years later, they're doing pretty well. And it was the British government who said that they were looking for women at risk, women who had been isolated from their communities. So we made this recommendation, and now we found that, in fact, it was a wonderful thing for these women and a great deal of generosity from the government of the UK, which is exactly what is happening around the world. Okay, with regard to countries resettlement, so the highest resettlement countries this year, or last year for 2025, are Canada with 11,995 people, Australia with 7,253, the United States with 68,062 from the beginning of the year before the suspension, France with 3,056, and New Zealand with 1,286. This year we have 17 countries that are offering resettlement, and including some very small numbers, but coming from countries that are really grateful for those small numbers. So they're forming a bilateral partnership through the work that they're doing. Numbers change throughout the year. So we gave 2025 because that's the last complete year.
Thank you very much, Jackie, and thank you very much, Carlotta. I think this was the last question. So thank you very much. If you can make sure that the report and the... Yes. And the notes have been shared on the journalist emails. Thank you. So let's now go to UNICEF. Ricardo, you wanted to introduce the subject and your speaker, Tom Slaymaker, who is the chief of the WASH, Climate and Environment Data Unit, who is reaching us from Florence. Welcome to both. Ricardo.
Thanks, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Yes, Tom will speak with all of you in a second. But just before to let you know that today UNICEF launched a new report, the Children's Climate Risk Report 2026, which provides a comprehensive picture of how climate change is affecting children around the world. As we've said repeatedly, the climate crisis is no longer a future threat for children. It is already shaping their lives today, their health, their education, and their futures. You should have received the final report, the executive summary, and press release by email. Please let me know on the chat or by email if you haven't. I'll pass now to Tom without further ado. Thanks for joining, Tom, and over to you.
Thank you, Ricardo, and good morning, everyone. Imagine having to swim across a fast-moving river known for its strong currents and for crocodiles just to make it to school. That's a daily reality now for 15-year-old Lorna and her classmates in Papua New Guinea. The bridge linking their homes to school was destroyed by floods, leaving them no safe way to cross. But getting to the classroom is non-negotiable, so they put their books and their school uniforms in a bucket and swim in perilous waters. So for these children, the impact of climate change is not an abstract or future concern. It's a reality pushing them to risk their lives to not miss out on school. Today, UNICEF has launched a new analysis that shows just how widespread this reality has become. Almost every child in the world is now exposed to at least one climate hazard, such as floods, droughts, storms, or extreme heat. But one of the biggest concerns globally is that many children are facing multiple overlapping threats at once. The data show that nearly half of the world's children, or 1.1 billion children, are exposed to at least three climate hazards. And in some parts of the world, children are facing as many as six climate hazards. And these multiple overlapping shocks are building on top of each other and reshaping children's lives. So in the Sahel, for example, millions of children are already dealing with extreme heat, drought, sand and dust storms all at the same time. In countries like Bangladesh, Myanmar, Pakistan, children are exposed to more hazards and at greater intensity than almost anywhere else in the world. And in small island states, such as Haiti or Vanuatu, a single storm can overwhelm entire systems overnight. So this is not a warning of what is to come. It's a recognition of our current reality and an acknowledgement of how much worse it could get for children. When climate hazards overlap, the impacts tend to compound. So a drought can leave children hungry and malnourished. And a flood that follows can then contaminate water supplies and spread diseases like cholera. And each shock makes the next one more dangerous. And children can't always recover from shocks before the next one hits. So for the children I mentioned in Papua New Guinea, they are adapting to one climate shock by swimming across the river to school. But what happens when the next one comes? And the floodwaters rise and the river gets faster and a dangerous journey becomes deadly. So no country is untouched by climate risks, but imagine a child in conflict-affected countries, the Central African Republic, Chad, Haiti, or Sudan. Because they have much lower access to essential services, such as healthcare, nutrition, water and sanitation, even a moderate flood or a drought can put their life at risk. Today, I think 634 million children globally still lack safe drinking water, and a billion children lack safe sanitation. So climate hazards are making these already fragile conditions worse by increasing the risk of diarrhea, for example, which is one of the biggest killers of children under five. At least 242 million children had their schooling disrupted by climate hazards in 2024. And many more children have been displaced from their homes, increasing the risk of family separation or violence or exploitation, and of course, childhood trauma. Children have done the least to cause the climate crisis, and yet they are paying the highest price. So our goal at UNICEF is to make children more visible and to show where the action is most urgent by highlighting where hazards overlap and where children are most vulnerable UNICEF's latest analysis enables governments to identify those who are most at risk and take action to strengthen essential services to protect children before the next shock hits. And we know what works. Installing solar power to keep children learning during power outages, switching to groundwater aquifers for drinking as surface water sources dry up, upgrading sanitation systems to recycle water for farming, and building shelters to protect children and their families from tropical storms. The message is clear. Climate change is not only changing the planet, but also children. And without urgent, child-focused climate action, the shocks they face today will only intensify. But with the right investment and the political will, we can reduce the risks, strengthen systems, and give children the chance to survive and to thrive. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The audio was not perfect, so I like to ask Ricardo to make sure that the notes are shared on the email. Is there any question for UNICEF in the room or on the platform? I don't see any hand up, so thank you very much. And really, Ricardo, if you can make sure that the notes get to everyone as soon as possible. Thank you. So let's go now to IFRC. Oh, sorry, there is a question from Gorgi. Gorgi, is that a question for Tom?
Oui, oui, désolé. Je vais poser ça en français. J'aimerais lui demander, aujourd'hui, c'est la journée de l'enfant africain. Je ne sais pas vous si Madame la directrice vous en avez parlé. Et est-ce que vous êtes au courant? Et par rapport à l'UNICEF, est-ce qu'il y a quelque chose fondamentalement qui est fait aujourd'hui pour concernant justement le monitoring des enfants à réfugiés, notamment réfugiés climatiques? Et c'est l'occasion pour moi de saluer celui qui a été à l'origine de la création de ce mot même de réfugiés climatiques, notre frère et ami le regretté Jean Ziegler. Merci.
Merci à vous, Gorky. Tom, do you speak French? Do you want me to translate?
Could you translate the question for me? I couldn't hear it very well.
Yeah, the audio is not, it's really not fantastic. But basically, our journalist from Senegal, from two media in Senegal, was asking, was mentioning that today is the day of the African child. And to know if there is anything that you were saying about that and if you're doing any specific survey of the situation of African children, in particular with respect to climate change. I hope I translated well.
Yes, we are aware, and our colleagues across Africa will be celebrating the Day of the African Child. We, as UNICEF, collect a lot of information on the situation of children and how that is changing on nutrition and education, health, water and sanitation. And so we have together published an overview of the situation of children in Africa, along with the African Union. Those exact same data are the ones which are feeding into the report, which I have been talking about. So in our child climate risk report, what we do is we estimate the number of children who are exposed to each of these major climate hazards, and also the numbers who are exposed to multiple overlapping climate hazards. And then we put that information together with information on children's vulnerability. So whether they have access to basic services, whether they have access to healthcare, access to schools, access to nutrition services. And it's those which are the most highly exposed and are the most vulnerable who we consider to be at the highest risk. So all of that information is presented in the report, and we highlight lots of examples across Africa.
Thank you very much. Looking at Ricardo, if he wants to add anything. No. So thank you very much to both speakers for this spotlight on the situation of children and climate and environment. I'll now go to our colleague of IFRC. I've got Paolo Cravero with me on the podium, and I believe Bruno Michon, operations manager for the Ebola outbreak, is connected from the DRC. You want to start, Paolo, or we go directly to him?
Happily start. Just say a couple of words. Sure. I wanted to add that Bruno, as mentioned, is our operation manager for the Ebola outbreak. He's based in Bunia, in Eastern DRC, and he can take questions both in English and in French. Bruno?
Thank you very much, and good morning. So yes, I'm speaking to the DRC Red Cross in the Ebola response. What I see every day in that outbreak is not only a medical crisis, it's also a crisis of trust. Since the start of the Bundibuyo Ebola virus outbreak, the IFRC has been supporting the DRC Red Cross to engage communities, share trusted information, support safe and dignified burials, and help to break the chain of transmission. The strain of Ebola presents a very particular challenge. There is currently no approved vaccine and no specific treatment for Bundibuyo Ebola virus disease. And this makes early detection, early care, community engagement, infection prevention, and safe and dignified burials even more critical. But you know, when there is uncertainty, rumors can spread very quickly. A recent IFRC community feedback report, based on what our volunteers are hearing directly from the community, shows that some people still question whether the disease is real. Some, they believe the outbreak was invented to attract foreign monies. Others see safe and dignified burials as an attack to culture and tradition, rather than a measure to protect families and communities. Deaths are not abstract issues. They directly affect the response. Why? When people are afraid, they may not report symptoms. They may avoid treatment centers. Families try to bury their loved ones according to traditional practices without knowing the level of risk involved. And our volunteers, they are directly exposed to these tensions. In recent days, DRC Red Cross volunteers have faced verbal abuse, threats, and even physical attacks while carrying out their job. These volunteers are local people. They come from the same community they are trying to protect. They are doing very difficult, sometimes very dangerous work with courage and commitment. This is why trust is not a secondary activity in the Ebola response. Trust is central. Without trust, we cannot detect cases early. We cannot ensure safe and dignified burials. We cannot even protect families, and we cannot stop the transmission. Following community feedback, we started using body bag with a window so that the family can see the face of the diseased and begin to process the grieving. When communities told us they feared that chlorine was used to poison them, we did not argue. We demonstrated how disinfectants are prepared. We explained that what chlorine does and why it matters to fight the virus. Now, I can see that we see signs of hope. Here in Italy, I have seen volunteers speaking with families for hours. I have seen community leaders to try to help reduce tensions. I have seen local teams to continue their work even after very difficult incidents. Community, we know that they are not passive recipients of assistance. They are essential partners in the response. Ebola starts in community and it will end with communities. The IFRC and the DRC Red Cross will continue to listen carefully, to respond quickly to community feedback, and to adapt the operation when needed. To stop the outbreak, we need to invest not only in medical response, but also in trust, in local volunteers, community engagement, and operational access. Building trust takes time. It requires honesty, patience, and humility. But in this outbreak, it is not optional. It is life-saving. So to further scale up this effort to earn trust and save life, we call on the international community to continue supporting it through generous contribution and solidarity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bruno. Thanks for this important update. Let me see if there are questions for you in the room. Yes, Alex, AFP.
Yes, thank you very much for this briefing. Apart from this crisis of trust, we heard yesterday several organizations like MSF and Oxfam saying that there are still gaps in the response to Ebola outbreak in DR Congo. They're arguing, for example, that the epidemic is advancing faster than efforts to contain it. Do you share that assessment today in Bunia?
Bruno?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for this question. I've seen also the statement of MSF yesterday saying that the epidemic goes faster than the response. Here in Bunia, what I can see is that we did not reach the peak of the epidemic. And I think that's why what MSF wanted to say. It's probably true because we lack a lot of test capacities. So it's very difficult to know exactly to what extent the epidemic is spreading. So yes, I think I share this, this analysis that the response has been more and more efficient. We are trying to now to continue to develop and to decentralize our activities in the different provinces. But yes, the peak is, I think, not behind us, but in front of us.
Thank you very much. Emma Farge, Reuters.
Hello. Just a question on what you said on testing. Can you tell us what the testing turnaround time is these days in the Bunia area and the consequences of delays for testing? And secondly, are people avoiding healthcare centers because they're afraid of hospitals? What are they telling you? And how worried are you about the impact on other diseases because people aren't showing up? Thank you.
Thank you. I will reply to your second question first, if you don't mind. Yes, why people don't go to the hospital and ETC, the Ebola Treatment Center? Because two main reasons. The first one, they are afraid to go there and to be contaminated. And that's very, basic reaction we can understand. So when they have symptoms such as fever, they prefer to stay home. They don't report those symptoms. But also the second reason is that this Ebola virus, there is a lot of stigmatization around that disease. So people are ashamed also to tell the family or to tell the population that they are sick. So they do not report cases, and that's one of the issues because it multiplies the possibility of contact cases and also the spread of the disease. Regarding the test, I must say that I've seen a lot of improvement. The strain is a new one. So at the very beginning, it was strictly impossible to test because it was always negative. But now the Ministry of Health has deployed with WHO a lot of capacities to test the population, but still it can take 12 hours, sometimes 24 hours before to get the results. And during that time, we have to keep the patient in the treatment center. They have to keep the patient in very difficult places. And that's why we must absolutely increase the number of testing, but also the rapidity of the results.
Thank you very much. I know that Tariq is on the line. Tariq, please feel free to come in if you need to add anything. Yeah, Emma, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, if I may, you said these people are waiting in isolation for the test results. Are you seeing incidents where they're sick of waiting and they're leaving and therefore risking a spread of the disease? Tell me what you're seeing on the ground.
IFRC and DRC Red Cross are not managing Ebola treatment center. We do work with the community to engage with the community, and we are in charge of the safe and dignified border. So I don't want to speak on behalf of organizations who are managing the ETC, but true that they reported some people who escape from the ETC. Who ran away, who didn't want to stay in the center, and who left during the night, for example. So, but again, IFRC is not in charge of the medical response. We do work with the community to engage with them, and we are also working with safe and dignified barriers.
Okay. Yeah, Alex.
Yes, thank you. You're saying that the peak is ahead of us. Could you estimate when it could be reached? And also, I'd like to have the input of Tariq on this one, and also a reaction from Tariq for the MSF statement yesterday. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll start with Bruno and then give the floor to Tariq.
Well, it's very difficult to know when the peak will be reached. What I can say is that when I did arrived 3 weeks ago, 12 of the territories of the province were affected, and today 21 are affected. The province is divided into 34 territories, but today more than 2/3 of the territories report a positive case of Ebola. So, and that is a trend since 3 weeks. I believe that it will continue like that during the coming weeks. We do have cases also reported in Kivu, North Kivu, South Kivu. We are afraid that this could last 1 year before to end this disease.
Let me see, Tariq, can you?
Yes, yeah, can you hear me, Alessandro?
Yeah, we can see you and hear you. Go ahead.
Thanks. I can really just echo what Bruno has said. And you have heard last Friday from our Dr. Olivier Le Polon, and he was very clear that the number of cases is expanding. There is a 31 health zone now affected. That the number of alerts remain low, which is particularly in the high-risk areas, and that the contact tracing is below target. So definitely, as Bruno said, we are not there yet. So I think we all agree on that. We need what are the key drivers of the epidemic and what needs to be done. We need to make sure that we know where transmission chains are, that people who are infected do not infect other people. And that means that they stay, they get the care they need. And then for those who unfortunately died, that we do safe and dignified burials, as Bruno mentioned. So I'll just add a few things on diagnostics. So in DRC, there is now, this work is led, as Bruno said, by National Institutes for Biomedical Research. And they implement a decentralized laboratory strategy. There are now testing capacities in 6 locations in DRC, in Mongwalu, Wiro, and Bukavu. In addition to existing capacity in Bunia, Kinshasa, and Goma, there are also 4 laboratories are activated in Uganda for Bundibugyo virus. And we, together with partners, are replenishing laboratory reagents, testing supplies, and other consumables that are needed. Back to you.
Thank you, Tarek. Thank you for adding this. You wanted the comment?
Yeah, and yeah. If we can have a comment about what MSF said yesterday.
If MSF, yeah. So I as I said, like we really need to make sure that all the elements of the response are in place for the time being. As Dr. Pollan said, we are have blind spots where we get a low number of alerts. There may be transmission chains that are not being detected. There are still people who are risking to infect other people, and we need to get them. And again, to go back to what Bruno was saying, a community trust is the key. We need people to understand that the best way to end this outbreak is to work with the Ministry of Health, national health authorities, and all the partners, and to implement public health measures.
I think it's okay, Alex? Yeah, okay. Okay, so thank you very much. I don't see other questions for IFRC or Tarek for the moment. So thanks a lot for the briefing. Thank you, Bruno. Good luck with your important work. And let me now welcome our colleagues of UNIDIR. I see Claudia is connected. Good morning, Claudia. And I have the pleasure to have with me Giacomo Persi Paoli, the head of the Security and Technology Program of UNIDIR. You want to start directly, or Claudia wants
to? I don't know if Claudia wants to say something before.
Claudia, do you want to add to start? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning. Just a brief introduction on the reason why we're here today. So the UN Institute for Disarmament Research will host this week the second edition of its global conference on AI security and ethics. Over the next over the 2 days, the conference will bring together diverse actors, including diplomats, policymakers, academia, civil society, industry, and the research community, to examine how AI is already reshaping security and what this means for global governance. And to provide an update on this year's key themes and program, as well as the critical moment where this conference is taking place, I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Giacomo Persi Paoli, head of the UNIDIR's Security and Technology Program. Giacomo specializes in the implications of emerging technologies, particularly AI and cyber, on international peace and security. And his work focuses on the governance of these transformative technologies, including their impact on arms control, strategic stability, and global frameworks. Giacomo, over to you now.
Thank you, Claudia, for the introduction. Good morning, colleagues, and thank you for joining us. I'm really pleased to brief you today on UNIDIR's Global Conference on AI Security and Ethics, which will take place, as Claudia mentioned, this Thursday and Friday, 18th and 19th of June here at the Palais des Nations and online. The timing of this conference is very important. As we know, artificial intelligence is no longer a future or abstract policy issue. It is already shaping current security environments as well as the relationship between states and private technology actors. Issues such as AI-enabled drones on the battlefield or intelligence analysis for target identification, deepfakes and AI disinformation, AI-powered cyber attacks on critical infrastructure are becoming increasingly common features of modern conflict, and the debate on human control in terms both of morality and accountability is increasingly central. For policymakers, the question is how to govern AI development and use in ways that are consistent with international law, responsible practice, and civilian protection. But this is also a particularly important moment for multilateral engagement. Our conference is taking place immediately after the informal exchanges on AI in the military domain currently taking place here at the Palais, and just a few weeks before the first global dialogue on AI governance, another outcome of the last General Assembly. The conference also builds on the growing debate around AI, both within and outside the UN, including the Secretary's General report on AI in the military domain and broader General Assembly efforts that are really trying to move from high-level principles towards implementation, practical measures, and sustained engagement among stakeholders. The purpose of our conference is to bring together communities that do not always have an opportunity to speak to each other or don't do so enough. Diplomats, policymakers, military and defense experts and practitioners, civil society, human rights experts, international organizations, and industry. The program is organized over 2 days. The first day will focus specifically on technology. We will look at some of the core technical and operational issues that policymakers really need to understand better. We will also examine concrete areas of application and integration of artificial intelligence, including AI principles across the product life cycles, infrastructure independence, AI resilience, and other issues. The second day will focus more directly on governance questions. It will include discussions on the role of investors, the responsibility chain from international norms to industry practice, some regional perspectives from Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America, as well as the role of the UN in advancing practical governance measures. We'll also explore the convergence of AI with other disarmament fields and close with some reflections on possible ways ahead. We're fortunate to have a strong and diverse program. The conference will open with Unity's director, Dr. Robin Geis, followed by an executive-level fireside chat with Ms. Izumi Nakamitsu, the High Representative for Disarmament Affairs, who will be joining us in person. Also in person are two other high-level engagements, including one with Ambassador Philip Tigo, the Kenya's Special Envoy for Technology, as well as with Rafael Grossi, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency and a current candidate to become the next UN Secretary General. For UNIDIR, this conference is part of a broader body of work on AI, peace, and security, and follows the launch of UNIDIR's Center of Excellence on AI, Peace, and Security. This new center will be launched tomorrow and has been established thanks to the generous contributions of a number of donors, including the Foundation for the Adaptation of International Geneva. Over recent years, UNIDIR has conducted research, dialogue, and capacity building on responsible AI in the military domain, including through its roundtable for AI security and ethics, our work on international governance processes, regional and national work, and research on military AI governance. Our aim is really to help member states and the wider stakeholders community to move from general concern to more concrete understanding and more informed decision-making and governance options. A key point I really want to emphasize is that our conference is not designed to be a platform for political debate or for consensus building. It is really designed as a forum for serious and sometimes potentially difficult multi-stakeholder dialogue. AI in the security domain raises questions that are technically complex, that are politically sensitive, and ethically consequential, and they cannot really be answered by avoiding difficult perspectives and exchanges. They require scrutiny, critical engagement, and direct conversations among the actors that are shaping, using, or regulating these challenging technologies. And this is why we've built a program that takes into account all of this different range of perspectives. Our hope is that the conference will contribute to a more informed global conversation on AI security and ethics, and one that is grounded on and in international law, that is attentive to risks, but is also open to innovation and focused on practical steps that can support responsible governance. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Giacomo and Claudia. Any question to our colleagues of UNIDIR? Don't see any. Nick Amin-Bruce, The New York Times, online.
Yeah, thank you for that. I just wondered if you could say a word on where this is actually taking place and what access there may be for journalists to your deliberations. Thank you.
Sure. The conference is taking place inside the Palais at Tempus. It's open. Registration is open. If you're accredited to enter the UN, you can come in, no problem. There is no restrictions to access. If you're not registered to or accredited to enter the UN, you can register to the conference and you will have access to it. It will also be, all sessions will be broadcasted online. So in case you cannot follow it in person, all the content will be available in real time online.
Yes, thank you. I have not exactly understood yet what the result of this conference is. Everyone's talking, the topics are great. Is there going to be an outcome, a document? Are there agreements? And do you have people around the table who matter in this case? Are there representatives of the United States, of Russia, of Israel, those countries that pursue with great vigor, including AI in their weaponry? China probably too. Thank you.
Thank you. So the full program, including the full list of speakers, is available on the conference website, on Unity's website. There you will see a very interesting combination of state representatives, including from the countries, some of the countries that you've mentioned, industry players, including from some companies that are actively developing this technology. So we've really tried to assemble a set of speakers and participants that can help us better understand in practice how this technology is being developed, used, and potentially governed. There isn't going to be a formal negotiated outcome document. That's not what Unity's conferences normally are used to, but there will be a conference report that will summarize the main discussion points, the main findings, and potentially some ways ahead that have been identified during the conference.
Any other question? I don't see any, so I'd like to thank our colleagues of UNIDIR. And since you've mentioned Mr. Grossi, I'm going to my announcements. And the first one is that you are very soon going to receive an invitation for a press conference by Rafael Mariano Grossi, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who will speak to you from this room on the 18th of June, Thursday, at 9:30. So the invitation is coming. It's going to be an hybrid press conference, but they would very much welcome your presence in the room. I'm going to give you the information on to whom to ask the questions, if you have any, because I think you don't have them on the list of the spokesperson. So you can write to genevaoffice@iaea.org. And that's going to be at 9:30. On the contrary, you have received the invitation for the other two press conferences that I'd like to remind you. One is also on the 18th of June, but at noon, and is going to be given by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, Irene Kahn. She's going to speak about freedom of expression in new frontiers, big tech, and regulation of digital spaces. And on the 19th of June, so that's going to be Friday, 12:30, after the briefing, there will be a press conference by the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health on her report to the current council, and it will focus on health as an enabler of dignity. And of course, as you know, the Human Rights Council is continuing its second 62nd regular session, the Assembly Hall. Let me remind you that on Thursday evening at 6:30 p.m. at the Cinerama Empire, Rue de Carouge, we will hold the next Cine Unu. Join us for this session, as I said, 6:30. And the movie that we are going to screen is called Lost Land. It's a poignant yet tender odyssey told from a child's perspective. It's the story of a four-year-old Shafi and 9-year-old sister Sumira leaving a Rohingya camp in Bangladesh to travel to Malaysia, hoping to reunite with their family. And after the screening, we will have a discussion on the right to seek safety, a shared protection for all of us. There will be two colleagues, one from OHCHR, Pierre Beroy, and the other one from UNHCR, Madeleine Garlick, to speak about this matter. And the event is part of World Refugee Day that, as you know, the international community commemorates on the 20th of June. Just a reminder that tomorrow it's World Day to Combat Desertification and Drought. You have received the message of the Secretary General. And on the 18th of June, the international community commemorates the International Day for Countering Hate Speech. If there is something that we really need to do, is countering hate speech at the moment. The Secretary General says, in our digital age, hate speech spreads faster than ever, amplified by unregulated platform and intensified by artificial intelligence. But practical solutions exist. states have clear obligation under international law to combat incitement to hatred and to promote inclusion, respect for diversity and solidarity. I'd like to remind you, as the Secretary General does, that the United Nations have adopted the UN Strategy and Plan of Action on Hate Speech, which points the way, while the Global Principles for Information Integrity provide a roadmap to a safer, more ethical digital ecosystem. And the SG, the Secretary General, to conclude on this fifth International Day for Countering Hate Speech, let us reject prejudice in all its form and work together to build a world based on human rights, dignity, and respect. I think this is all I had in terms of announcements. I see John has a question. Go ahead, John. And if I may say, yes, happy birthday.
Good morning, Alessandra. I don't know if the representative of Unity is still there or he left.
He's here.
I had a question.
He's
here. I was wondering if he could elaborate. Who is sponsoring the conference?
He is coming on the podium. John, can I wish you happy birthday? I understand you're celebrating today.
Sort of, yes.
Have a nice day. Happy birthday day. Giacomo.
Yes, thank you for the question. I believe the sponsor list is also included on the conference webpage, but the sponsors of the conference are the sponsors also of UNIDIR's, as I mentioned, the Center of Excellence on AI, Peace and Security. They include a combination of states and other sectors. So I mentioned FAGI, the Foundation for the Adaptation of International Geneva. And then we have Microsoft from the private sector, and then we have a combination of states, France, Italy, Germany, Pakistan, Republic of Korea, and the Netherlands. I hope I did. I didn't forget anyone. It was a memory exercise, but in any case, it is the full list is available on the conference page and also displayed at the entrance of the conference center in Tempus.
And I'm looking at Claudia. Maybe we can, if you can share the notes and the link to the page. And we will also put it in the summary of the briefing, of course. Gorky?
Juste le document que vous avez lu du secrétaire général sur les hate speeches, est-ce qu'on peut l'avoir s'il ne s'est pas encore envoyé? Ce serait magnifique. Deuxième question, c'est M. Grossi. Sa conférence, est-ce qu'on peut savoir il va parler de quoi? Parce que je pose cette question, c'est naïvement, parce que je me dis... Lui, il est candidat pour le poste de secrétaire général. C'est lui, il vient faire une conférence de presse aux Nations Unies à Genève sur une question peut-être qui n'a pas été pertinemment posée auparavant et que les autres candidats ou candidates aient cette information. J'ai peur que cela puisse être quelque chose qui pourrait être jugé comme étant favorable à lui et défavorable aux autres. Donc, je pose cette question de manière très claire et très naïvement, mais donc, l'idée serait de savoir de quoi il va nous parler. Je pense que je me suis fait bien comprendre.
Oui, oui, absolument. Absolument, j'ai tout à fait compris. Alors, les discours du secrétaire général, l'adresse du secrétaire général pour cette journée devrait, en principe, être dans vos boîtes à lettres et non pas seulement en anglais, mais aussi dans les autres langues officielles des Nations Unies. Si ce n'est pas le cas, on l'enverra tout de suite après le briefing. Et je sais que Solange m'écoute, donc on vous l'enverra au plus tôt dans les différentes langues. Pour ce qui concerne la conférence de presse de M. Grossi, j'ai demandé les titres et c'est juste un briefing de presse avec M. Grossi en tant que directeur général de l'Agence internationale d'énergie atomique. Donc, donc ça c'est le titre, press briefing with IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Et si vous voulez en savoir plus, comme je dis, il faut écrire à ce bureau de l'IAEA ici à Genève, et peut-être que quand on enverra l'invitation, ce qui est en cours, vous aurez aussi les numéros de téléphone. Merci beaucoup. Je ne vois pas d'autres questions. Alors, je vous souhaite une bonne journée et puis je vous donne rendez-vous à vendredi. Merci.